Hi, I'm Ben McAdams. You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I represent the political center, and I'm joined by John Dougal on the right.
Hey, how you doing? I just feel this leftward shift if you're the center.
It's great. It's in a great world. And Shireen Gourbani on the left.
Hello, and hey, listeners. So glad you're tuning in.
Well, let's go ahead and jump in. There's been some exciting things happening both locally and nationally.
Yeah,
where do we want to start?
Well, yeah. I want to start with, I know that you've joined us a few times since we've been on Utah Public Radio, but tell us just a little
bit. I'm not sure you've ever been in the bunker with
us. Who are you?
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about you.
Well, for those who don't remember, you know, Ben McAdams, former mayor, former member of Congress, and occasional guest host of Both Sides of the Aisle.
That's right.
It's great to be back with you.
What have you been working on?
So my work lately, after I left Congress, I started my own consulting firm where, I do a handful of different kind of policy consulting. But my primary focus is it stems from some work that I did when I was mayor of Salt Lake County, looking at government-owned real estate. Governments acquire real estate have spent hundreds of years acquiring real estate, and there's really no mechanism to strategically use your real estate. So,
oftentimes they don't even necessarily know they have it. There's not a tax on it. So there's not a certain holding cost that normally in the private sector you have. So
they don't even know what it's worth, right? So the extent to which government looks at land is for the tax assessor. So the county assessor will look at every parcel of real estate in a county, and they'll sort them into two piles, taxable. And then they estimate a worth and they'll send you a tax bill. So everybody who owns a home gets that.
You just got that a few weeks ago.
That's right. Yeah. If it's government land, they flag it as tax exempt and they set it on the shelf and forget about it. And they can go hundreds of years and not look at this. So when I was mayor, I said, we should really know what land we own. So we did an inventory of all government-owned land in the Salt Lake Valley. And what we discovered was there are 44 square miles. So we excluded land that was like the watershed or the airport runway, right?
Sure.
This is land that just is kind of set aside for a different purpose. And what we looked at was commercially viable land that's government owned. So 44 square miles, roughly the size of the city of West Jordan.
When you say government, not federal? Are you talking?
Not federal. We're talking city, county, state, school district, but government owned, roughly the size of the city of West Jordan. And in 2017, we estimated that land was worth about $13 billion.
Yeah.
So the county budget's about $1 billion, so 13 times. So we kind of did some back of the envelope math back then and said, if you were to use this land in a way that generated roughly a 3% return, which isn't very good, right?
Yeah.
But a 3% return, we could eliminate property tax. You know, it's a sizable revenue stream for the taxpayer. So
what kind of, when you think about, well, if you could, get a return. So what kind of projects would that look like? What kind of things? Just give me an example of something that could happen on that land.
So, we've done this work now with about 15 cities across the country. We did this work for the city of Atlanta. And with Atlanta, we did a similar inventory for them. And one of the parcels we found in Atlanta was their salt pile. So Atlanta, doesn't snow very often, but when it does, their public works department needs to de-ice the roads.
Yeah.
So 75 years ago, they found cheap land in an industrial part of the city that was on an industrial rail corridor, and they bought several acres of land to store their salt. Fast forward 75 years. Now, they know they own that salt pile. They use it. They maintain it. But they don't really think about it in a strategic way. So we went to them and said, your salt pile is no longer in a low-value land, industrial part of the city, that area. That rail line has become the Beltline Trail, really some of the most expensive land in the city of Atlanta. And you've got salt sitting on land that's worth about $15 million. If you just pick up that salt and move it a couple miles away, you can buy land for probably a couple hundred thousand and free up $15 million. So what Atlanta wants to do is affordable housing.
Yeah.
In a neighborhood that is expensive and it's forcing out, a lot of people can't afford to live there anymore. They have $15 million piece of land where they can do workforce housing, affordable housing development. So that's what Atlanta is doing now.
That's a cool idea.
So I go in and work with cities and help them see their land and then think about how they can use it for job creation or revenue creation to offset, property tax revenue or others or affordable housing. So we've worked with cities like Atlanta, Cleveland, Annapolis, Maryland, just started working with Kansas City, Missouri. So we work with cities around the country to help them do this stuff. It's been a lot of fun.
So I love Cleveland. Just want to put that in there. But
Cleveland rocks.
It rocks. Yeah. When you hear this, John, from your perspective as a Republican and also as an auditor, what does it make you think about?
The key thing, a couple things comes to mind. First, it's how poorly government manages its resources.
Yeah.
And this is just one example. If they don't know what the property is or they're not looking to say, what is the purpose? They're just holding it just in case. You never know. It's kind of like that junk drawer at home. Yeah, you got it just in case something might be of value, rather than thinking about what is the best use of this land. And then I also hear, you know, if I bring it back right here to Salt Lake County, something that might pop up that people think about is the prison was put out there in Draper. At the time it was put out there 60 years ago, you know, that was dirt cheap in the boonies.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, the metropolitan area grew up right around it. And so there was a push to move it. It was the same thing if you go back even further, the prison that used to be here in Sugar House. Mm-hmm. And then the community grew up around it. And there was finally a point where developers and others were saying, we need to relocate this because there's a better use of this land.
Yeah. So one of the things we try to help governments think about is, well, sadly, one of the things they do is they see their land and the first thing they do is they sell it and then they upzone it and then they put transit by it and then they put open space by it. And they do all these things that enhances the value of the land after they've sold it. So we help them think about how instead of like giving that the upside of that land to a single developer, help the public take advantage of it. Maybe it's revenue to support, to lower taxes or to support priorities, or maybe it's affordable housing, or it's to fund open space or transit. In, you know, in Europe and Asia, Hong Kong built their entire mass transit system without tax dollars, just by knowing that when they put in a transit system, they're going to enhance the value of their land and repurpose that into land development. So that's what I do.
I love it. Well, thanks for giving it.
Okay, one of the other key things I'd say is the thing that scares me, though, is the notion that says government start to get in the land development business.
Yeah.
Because I think here in Utah, we've seen too much of that.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's exactly the stuff I like to nerd out on and how to find that right balance. So
I love this kind of stuff, too. I think it's actually interesting because, John, you think of yourself as a wonk. I know you to be quite a lover of policy. I am, too. And I have to say, I'm also into big political vibes. So we've had a big political vibe shift.
Should I disclose that I've read the book he shared with me a couple of years ago on this?
Okay.
Yes. Oh, I love it. So you really are a nerd, is what you're saying.
I am a nerd.
I do know both of you to be policy nerds. You can't hide it, too.
It's true.
Let's hear about the vibe.
So in our last episode, we did speculate about who may be the VP pick for Kamala Harris. Now we know it
here's,
is...
here's the participation trophy for Shireen for winning. Congratulations.
Thank you. So I...
get out that magic eight
ball. I'm married to a Minnesotan, so I follow Minnesota politics pretty closely and have been really impressed with the Walz administration. And Tim Walz, I think, is a really interesting person because similar to you, he won a congressional district that was before you won yours, but that was red, a pretty red district in southern Minnesota. It's not... a progressive, I don't think people would think about it as a progressive corner of the state, but he won that congressional seat. He was able to hold on to it. We can talk about sort of more about his background and who he is. But I think that there are some interesting lessons when you run in red places. And I think he brings an interesting perspective to the ticket. But also, I am just absolutely loving I'm on Team Tim Walz. I like it.
You are so weird.
Well, he has brought an interesting energy to the race. You know, first of all, Kamala has brought some interesting energy to the race that's just has Democrats excited, waking up, talking about it.
It's because they were so desperate.
Well,
they're
I know
in despair.
It is a low bar. I thank you to Joe Biden and the work that he's done, but there was no energy from the top of the ticket on the way down, all the way down. And now it's exciting to see people energized, you know, and I think he brings some interesting, like building out some, you know, well-rounded depth to the ticket.
So he grew up in Nebraska in a small town. I think that he said his graduating class maybe had like a dozen people in it, right?
Come on. Mind your own damn business.
Yeah, mind your own business. Went into the Army National Guard, lived in China. Came back, worked as an educator. And one of the things that I love teachers. I was raised by a teacher and just kind of the stories that are coming out from his students. And I think there's some really interesting ones that are popping up from their 30s, whatever, Republicans saying, you know, we always speculated. We never knew his politics, but we knew he was passionate about democracy, about government, about social studies more broadly. I think it's a really interesting model. Minnesota is a wonderful place to live. I have a lot of family members who live there. And I think there is a really you know, you kind of joked about it, John, but I do think there is, I think we could stand a politics that has individuals who mind their own damn business a little bit more than we have now.
Oh, on both sides of the aisle.
On both sides of the aisle. So I love that message, and I just
wish you really believed it and didn't just say it.
Yeah. I mean, you can say that, but I can think of a few examples where he does. Any other kind of perceptions on this choice?
You know, I've been back to D.C. recently and talking to my colleagues and friends in Congress. Now, I did not serve with Tim Walz. He had left before I was elected, but, you know, just such immense respect for him from people on both sides of the aisle there, too, for how he was a blue dog. So, you know, as I was when he was in Congress. And so we have a lot of mutual friends and just highly, highly respected as a problem solver, somebody who is also a policy nerd and likes to get things done. So,
yeah, John,
I mean, not being a Democrat, I would have loved to see somebody else on the ticket that I would have thought would have brought more strength. But I recognize, you know, given the situation, he's supposed to be a certain attack dog. He gives a certain vibe as dad or coach to that, his policies. I look and say, okay, maybe he was more of a blue dog when he was representing a Republican district. It looks like as a governor, he was a very liberal kind of governor in terms of various policies.
Yeah, those very liberal policies at school.
But to me, I look, as I think I said last week, Kamala, you know, if she picks Walz, it's kind of singing to the choir. Just like J.D. Vance, when Trump picked him, was singing to the choir. I didn't really view it as expanding the base.
Yeah. So I do want to stop for a second and talk about the school lunch policy, which I think is actually one that I hope Utah will consider. Minnesota decided to do free breakfast and lunch for their students, and what they found was just a huge jump in attendance. And so we know that these kinds of programs, while they get painted all the time as progressive or liberal, are fundamentally good for kids who are learning. So I would just give that as one point of many points of interesting things that Minnesota is doing to make it a more family-friendly state.
Well, and some of the things that he's painted as being liberal are things that we have here in Utah, too. You talk about a driving privilege card or, you know, what else was it? Some of the things that he's painted for, you know, it was the tampons in bathrooms, right?
Yeah.
Passed the Utah legislature unanimously.
Right.
These aren't liberal policies.
Nope.
Maybe only in an election year where you're trying to smear somebody as this liberal.
I think that's right.
Yeah. So, you know, if it's passed unanimously through the Utah legislature, it's hard to classify it as liberal.
Maybe we just live in a progressive state and we didn't know. Anyway.
Well, what a great discussion. You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm with John Dougal and Shireen Gourbani. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on Utah Public Radio. We love to hear from listeners like you. If you would like to send us a comment, email bsotapodcast@gmail.com. That's bsotapodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Shireen Gourbani on the left.
John Dougal, mailing it in from the right.
And I'm Ben McAdams in the political middle. You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. So interesting, some really interesting legal developments this week in the Utah elections that I think might be worth taking some time to unpack for our listeners.
I think it's a good idea. So we have a couple of cases that have been before emergency hearings before our Supreme Court. John, since it is your party, will you give us, let's start with the Lyman situation.
Well,
what's Phil Lyman up to?
Let's start with Colby Jenkins.
Okay, let's start with Colby Jenkins.
Okay, so on the Colby Jenkins one.
He's running against Celeste Molloy, right, for Congress.
Celeste Molloy, 2nd Congressional District, and there was a recount there. And the recount separates him by, I think it's about a little over 170 votes.
That's right.
It is really darn close. And there's a few hundred ballots that were received that had a late postmark. And so therefore they weren't counted. And there's a debate and arguments about whether or not they should be counted and so forth. And I will note there's inconsistency because I remember back in 2020, various folks supporting Donald Trump saying ballots received after election night should not be counted. And now there's an argument saying we should count ones that weren't even postmarked by the day before the election and count those. And so there's a little inconsistency for some people from my perspective. But so the debate is, and there was an argument in front of the Supreme Court on Friday that did not go well for Colby Jenkins and his attorney. His attorney appeared to be an out-of-state attorney that wasn't quite familiar with some of the dynamics of Utah, that there's supposed to be drop boxes for ballots in every municipality, that you can vote in person, that Utah didn't print their ballots in August. In fact, they couldn't even start printing them until September. In fact, you had Justice Pierce say one time, "You do know you're arguing before the Utah Supreme Court." And yeah. Justice Pierce was quite irritated because they gave an emergency hearing to this on the reliance that it was imminent because you had to block the printing of the ballots, which was not correct. And therefore, he sounded quite perturbed at the court granting this emergency hearing when it wasn't an emergency at that point.
Yeah.
And so for various reasons, I don't think it's going to go well.
And so Colby Jenkins is asking to, so these ballots that were not postmarked by the Monday before election, that's the law.
Yep.
They come from, he thinks that these late casts and where they came from are likely to favor Colby Jenkins and go against Celeste Malloy. So he thinks that it could overturn the election if they can include these ballots.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. And part of the dynamic in rural Utah is when you mail the ballots, it takes a while to get to the post office and so forth. And so I guess this is an issue that has been known for many years in terms of the delay. Mail them early because you don't know how many days it's going to take for that postmark to get on there. And I know some are saying, well, it went to Vegas and then came back. Well, St. George to Vegas is, what, an hour and a half? St. George to Salt Lake's 4 hours. So, I mean,
yeah.
I think the issue is not really where it was sent to. I think the issue is really how much time does it take from when you drop it in your mailbox to when it actually gets a postmark on there? And clearly, this is a weakness. And it's not just a weakness in Utah. This is a weakness in some other states as well.
And the irony is rich because this is a situation where you, in 2020, you know, Trump is saying that, well, Shireen and I know because we've worked at the county level, these ballots that are come in by mail, they have to be thread just like your junior high exam through a Scantron,
yep.
right? And they can go fast, but you're manually feeding a ballot through one at a time. And so it's going to take a couple weeks. If you get all of these dumped on election day, it's going to take you a couple weeks to count them. And so Donald Trump in 2020 was playing off the perception that something nefarious was happening because we didn't know on election night what was happening and what the ballot, what the outcome was. And so therefore something suspicious and it should be thrown out. And so now it's rich to see the same people turning that around and saying every vote should be counted, even the ones that weren't postmarked by the day before election.
As
the law says, and as they would say, the cutoff should be, you know, 8 p.m. on election day and nothing should be counted after that.
Yeah.
You know, turning this around and really votes that are legitimately and legally cast in 2020 shouldn't be counted. And now votes that were not legally cast in 2024 should be counted.
So it's a
rich
little bit,
irony.
Yep. It's a rich irony. There's also, I think, the component.
But the principle is whatever it takes to win.
That's right. Yeah.
Of the drop boxes. I mean, the drop boxes for some folks, even if they are in every municipality, which I'm not sure they are in our rural counties, but you can have to drive hours still to get to a drop box. I guess I would just say for
and
our
that's
listeners,
what people on the Wasatch Front forget about.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, for us, it's 5 or 10 minutes away.
Yeah.
And but for others, it could be hours.
It could be hours. So I would just say for listeners, you know, as soon as you get that ballot, it behooves you to sit down, do a little research, figure out who you're going to vote for, and get that in the mail. If you do intend to vote by mail, because for those out there, it really can be multiple days before it comes back in. So yeah, it's quite the ordeal. Well, what's Phil Lyman up to?
So just recently, right, Phil Lyman announced that he is running for governor as a write-in candidate.
And I've heard two things. One, he's running as a write-in, or he's already to run as a write-in, but he's waiting for some litigation to proceed forward.
So his litigation is he's trying to claim that he should be on the ballot instead of Governor Cox because he was the rightful nominee coming out of convention, even though he lost overwhelmingly in the Republican primary. Is that right?
Lost in the primary.
In the primary,
I mean, I think it was closer than a lot of people predicted. But yeah, he lost in the primary. And part of what's at play is he has requested to see who signed the signature packet on behalf of Governor Cox. There was another candidate in Southern Utah where there's some issues of fraud for the folks that were collecting signatures down there who fraudulently had signatures put on one's packet. I think he's wanting to see whether that also took place for Governor Cox's packet. But because Utah law allows voters to mark their voter registration information as either private or withheld. Withheld is more restricted. You can think about certain police officers or domestic violence individuals versus more just I want it private and not shared with certain groups. Because of that, my understanding from the news reports is the Lyman campaign has requested what are the names of the people that signed Governor Cox's signature packet. And they got back about 60% of the names, about 40% of those that were validated were withheld or not disclosed.
Because the state has a legal duty to protect the privacy.
Yeah. And so you've got an interesting conundrum where you've got a problem in the law where I look and say, okay, you've got this general transparency that you should have in election process, but it does look like state law has a gap that says you know, certain folks cannot see this information, which then, you know, the Lyman camp says, well, how do we know that he got on the ballot legitimately if we can't actually see it and verify it?
Yeah.
You know, I just want to point out the rich irony again of these people who are arguing that only the party process and convention matters in Phil Lyman's race for governor. But how dare the Democrats put Kamala Harris as the leader of their ticket in spite of a primary election that where Joe Biden was on the ticket, right?
Yeah.
And so they're kind of, again, arguing, you know, outcome-based arguments instead of process-based arguments.
Yeah.
And richly
yeah.
ironic.
Yeah, it is. It continues to be baffling, unless the mental gymnastics that are displayed in many arenas of political thought in this state are, you know, something that you're more used to, which yeah. I feel like I've gotten quite accustomed to at this point.
And one of the things that would be interesting is if he does run in as a write-in, it would be very difficult to win an election.
Yeah.
But do you play the role of a spoiler? And I know there are some... What some would say staunch conservatives that are saying, I would rather have Brian King than Governor Cox, which,
yeah.
You know, what you think about the political spectrum, Brian King is much further to the left than Governor Cox on a whole array of policies.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, I've seen even Democrats online speculating that can Brian King in this scenario win a plurality? While he may not, it'll be hard for him to win a majority. He may win a plurality. And what does that mean? I think the political scientists and the pollsters will certainly, I think, look at that and see what that means. But
yeah.
I think Democrats have a sparkle of hope in their eyes. And
There's lots of hope for you.
I like to say, you can't be a Utah Democrat unless you are endlessly an optimistic.
Yeah. Well, if you look back decades ago when you had Leavitt and Merrill Cook in there, and I can't remember who the Democrat was. So Merrill was kind of a spoiler, but Mike Leavitt still got 40-something%.
Yeah.
So he still won.
Yeah.
And Merrill Cook was not a write-in candidate. He was actually on the ballot.
But I do think that Phil Lyman is a little bit of a it's a different beast, I think, because it does represent a pretty big fissure in the Republican Party in this state. And I think it's actually kind of organized. I'd be curious. I don't know. I have no sense of what that estimate would be. And I do think write-ins are very difficult. But it would be, I'm curious about what people would project that number to be.
Yeah. I don't know. I will just say, maybe I'll lament. And I think it's probably, I was going to say from the center, but I think we probably all share this. The state at which people are willing to tear down a system that we across the spectrum love and revere just because it might be in their short-term political interest. So, you know, a story I haven't shared very much, but in my 2020 campaign, there was an issue where a county clerk in San Pete County, a county that we knew I was going to lose 80-20, and did lose 80-20, but the county clerk had mailed out the ballots. And if you voted by mail, you know you have to sign the ballot, and your ballot doesn't count unless it's signed. Well, the county clerk mailed out ballots without a signature block on there. And so all these ballots were returned and were deficient under state law. So state law provides a mechanism for the county clerk to remedy this. That is not what the county clerk did. What the county clerk did was send out a signature form, said sign this and send it back in, that was disconnected from the ballot. So a lot of people signed this meaningless document and sent it back in. So we evaluated and thought, look, we might have an opportunity here to invalidate a lot of votes in San Pete County. And ultimately what it came down to me was saying this was an innocent mistake by a county clerk. And votes that were legitimately cast against me.
Yeah.
And was I willing to, on a technicality, try to throw out tens of thousands of votes because it would mean that I would win? And I ultimately decided that I cared more about democracy than I cared about holding on to a job in Congress, right?
Yeah.
That I cared about the will of the voters more than I cared about my job.
Yeah.
And, you know, imagine again the rich irony that it was only weeks later that Burgess Owens, who had defeated me, was arguing about stop the steal and overturning the Biden election and that on grounds that were much less solid than the ones on which he had won.
Right.
But I hope we get back to a point where people care about process, where they care about win or lose. We care about a process, and what brings us all together as Americans is the underpinnings of our democracy.
And one of the key things, we always need to look and say every process has weaknesses.
Yeah.
How do we improve and strengthen year after year, election after election? How do we strengthen the process? Because if we say, oh, it's great, don't worry about it, that breeds distrust. We always have to recognize there's weaknesses, and how do we look to improve it?
You know, that's one of the things I've always respected about John, and I would say Shireen too, but there's so much we disagree on. And I love to talk to you about what we disagree on, but I know that one of the things we do agree on is process and this democracy, and that there's a mechanism by which we settle our disagreements. Usually that mechanism means you win and I lose, but in Utah, but there's a common respect that I have for you because of the way that you, the values and integrity with which you approach this job.
So I'll just say, we don't have time to get into it, but I wanted to also just flag for listeners that there was a story about Utah's order to remove 13 books from public schools and libraries in the first statewide book ban. And of those 13 books, 12 of them are written by women. And I'll say one of them, Orcs and Crake by Margaret Atwood, is a beautiful book that I love. So there's not a good process there for challenging that. And kind of on that note of process, I hope we find one.
I hope so too. I think there's certainly is a legitimate conversation to say, what is age appropriateness?
Sure.
And age appropriateness is different than book bans, right? But age appropriateness in our elementary schools is certainly a conversation I think we all should be willing to engage in. And it's just unfortunate that's become so divisive.
Yep.
Look, you've been listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm Ben McAdams. I've been joined by John Dougal and Shireen Gourbani. Thank you to our producer, Anthony Scoma. And thank you to you, our listeners.